KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Campaigns are becoming much more sophisticated at kind of a retail door-to-door kind of identify the voters who will support you and contact them.
We have a package of interventions, vaccines, treatments, improving nutrition that can really and immediately bring down those deaths and save millions of lives.
Confidence and courage are the essentials of success carrying out our plan. You people must have faith. You must not be stampeded by rumors or guesses.
The power of radio in American politics. We're going to take a look back for our radio retrospective. Dr. Oren Levine is going to join us to talk about pneumonia. Monday is World Pneumonia Prevention Day. And you heard Bill Allison, who's editorial director at the Sunlight Foundation, talking about campaign financing and campaign funding. That's where we're starting today. What happened to all that money and what did it do? Bill Allison is the editorial director at the Sunlight Foundation. Their mission is to use the power of the internet to catalyze greater government openness and transparency and provide new tools for citizens and the media. Bill Allison, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you being on and talking about, to start with, what was the return on investment for some of this money? You took a look at it, and your headline was from one of your colleagues, "Today's election produced some big winners and some really big losers whose names never appeared on the ballot." In terms of money, was there smart money in this campaign, or did they throw their money away? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's easy to look at, you know, the end of the day and just say, okay, well, all this was spent on winners, and it was about actually, you know, if you calculate it based on the dollars spent and what candidates they were naming that they were either supporting or opposing, and then look at the results, only about 32% of it backed people where they got their desired result. They either defeated a candidate that they opposed or they elected a candidate they supported. But that being said, you know, I don't think you can say that this money wasn't an incredibly powerful driving force in the election. I mean, we know that every single candidate for Congress, we know anecdotally that members of Congress here in Washington were burning up the phone lines at the party headquarters. You know, they can't call and fundraise from their office. But when Congress was in session, they were spending a lot of their time raising money there. Out on the campaign trail, instead of meeting with voters, they were spending a lot more time with donors. And it's because they were afraid of or, you know, trying to build up a big enough war chest that they could withstand an attack from some of these outside groups. So it definitely had a dynamic effect on the election and changed the perceptions of politicians about how much fundraising they had to do. We saw Barack Obama raise about $1 billion. That's just incredible. That will be the benchmark from now on, that you won't be able to run a successful presidential campaign for less than $1 billion. I think that's just an astonishing fact. And again, one of the reasons why he built up that war chest was the concern about what the outside groups were going to be spending. So it definitely had an impact, even if it wasn't always that the outside groups, you know, elected their candidates. They definitely drove, it basically changed the entire complexion of fundraising in this campaign.
Well, that's the outcome of the way our campaigns are now allowed to be funded, isn't it? That we have seen the escalation in money raising because it's possible.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, it's kind of funny. A decade ago, we passed McCain-Feingold. We had our first election under it 2 years later, and it's as if that bill never happened. I mean, we have more money pouring into elections than we've ever had before.
You know, I was looking at the Center for Public Integrity. They were looking at spending as well, and they were taking a look at two particular big donors. One was Joe Ricketts from E-Trade. He put a lot of money, what was it, in the last month, $11.4 million into Ending Spending Action Fund, which is a super PAC, and the United Auto Workers, which put in $5.4 million into its super PAC in the last month as well. I mean, from all sides, people put millions of dollars into these campaigns. The UAW backing Democrats, they must have marshaled a lot of their own interest in Ohio and Michigan, in those places where they have some influence.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on the on the ending spending and Joe Ricketts, I mean, they were successful in about their dollars, just about a little more than 15%, supported either candidates that won that they wanted to win or lost that they wanted to lose. It's a kind of a phenomenal, when you think about how much money went into this and the results of it. But, on the union side, one of the things that, we wanted to pay a lot more attention to than just the money, and something we'll be looking at in the weeks ahead, is those get-out-the-vote drives, which really don't get the same amount of attention that, the ads do. And obviously the ads are ubiquitous, especially if you live in a battleground state. You just see them all the time in the presidential race. I live in Virginia, which was hotly contested, and it was just kind of wall-to-wall Obama and Romney ads. And at some point, those dropped off, and instead we had wall-to-wall Tim Kaine and George Allen ads. And I even got to the point where I was saying George Kaine and Tim Allen because I just couldn't keep the two of them straight. They were on the TV so much. It would just be, you'd have an Allen ad, a Kaine ad, another Kaine ad, an Allen ad, just kind of back to back to back. So the spending on ads is huge. But getting back to the get out the vote stuff, I mean, this is what UAW spent money on. A lot of the groups did spend money on get out the vote, and it was on both sides. I mean, I think Americans for Prosperity tried to do a lot of get out the vote stuff this time around. And, it's getting to the point where, if you're in a battleground state, you have people knocking on your door and stopping you in the street and, asking you, if they have a series of questions, they do the voter canvassing and then trying to get you to the polls on election day if they think you're going to vote their way.
Boy, Bill Allison, when you scroll down on your list of top spenders at the Sunlight Foundation, and the return on investment is one thing, but just their total spent. American Crossroads, $104 million. Crossroads Strategy, $70 million. National Republican Committee, $64 million. Democrats, $64 million. Senatorial, there's the House PAC, $30 million. I mean, it just goes on and on. SEIU, $15 million, and their political fund, another $14 million. It seems like an astounding amount of money, but so $1 billion from Obama, $6 billion in campaign funding, $6 billion in campaign spending maybe this year. But with the federal government in the trillions, and that's what they're trying to influence, yes, maybe it, from their point of view, it makes some sense, even if your return on investment looks low in some ways.
Well, I think this is always, always the case. And one of the things I always point to is, Lockheed Martin, which is a company that derives just about all of its revenue from federal government contracts. There's a few that they get from foreign countries, but those are generally funded by U.S. taxpayers. The U.S. gives, foreign governments money to then purchase arms from U.S. companies. And they have a few state contracts as well. But Lockheed Martin spends just a ridiculous amount of money lobbying. It's like $100 million. But they get, every single year, tens of billions of dollars back in contracts. It's like a very good return on investment for them. And for a lot of these guys, yes, they put up $10, $15 million trying to elect their guy. The Adelson family, Sheldon and his wife Miriam, put up, I think, like $52 million. And, they didn't get what they want, but, in the long run, they'll get somebody in who can help them at some point. And so, that's why they keep playing the politics game.
In your at the Sunlight Foundation, there's an article, Four Horse Races Where Outside Money May Have Pushed the Needle. And you look at three Republicans and one Democrat where the outside money may have helped these folks who are all incumbents stay in power. What's the thinking there? They just had enough money to marshal their forces?
I think that's the case. As I said, you have, these, I think there's two things going on. One is that, you have, with a lot of the freshmen, they were helped a lot by outside groups and getting elected the first time around, and these outside groups helped them the second time around. You got a guy like, folks like Joe Heck in Nevada or Andy Barr in Kentucky. With some of the with some of the candidates, though, who didn't get a lot of support from the outside groups, they had just tremendous fundraising operations on their own. And as I said, we know that members of Congress were burning up the phones and spending a lot of time with big donors throughout the the campaign season. And I think that this is kind of going to be the new normal for a while, is that you're going to see people, unfortunately spending much more time with donors than they do with constituents and they do with the people they represent.
So Bill Allison is editorial director of the Sunlight Foundation. If President Obama has sent the new benchmark with $1 billion to run a presidential campaign, and Mitt Romney wasn't too far behind, and $6 billion overall in campaign spending, and the court's ruling that money is speech, you have argued that one thing needs to happen is we need to have the transparency. We can't have the dark money. Why do we have so much dark money? And who supports the idea of the hidden donors?
Well, the dark money comes from and if you go back to the original case that set this all off, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. Citizens United is a 501c4 organization. That's the part of the tax code that they're created under, and what it basically means is that you can contribute to them. The contributions aren't tax deductible, but they are secret, and so the group can, and they were the ones who fought for the right to spend anything they wanted to opposing or supporting federal candidates. There's been a movement in Congress to pass something called the Disclose Act, which we think is absolutely necessary. I mean, it's something that, would be a good time to bring it up in the lame duck, when the memory of all the spending is fresh in members' minds. And certainly people like, Dick Lugar, who were, battered by, outside spending, and some other folks who are still there might be willing to give it a second look. The problem, though, is that right now in the House, Republicans aren't interested in passing this at all. And in the Senate, Mitch McConnell has argued that secret speech is protected by the First Amendment. And he's made this First Amendment argument that you should be able to spend whatever you want influencing elections and not have anybody know who you are. There's a problem with this in that, if you go back to the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, they said that transparency is the corrective measure and that as long as there's transparency, this money won't be corrupting. Well, there's not transparency when you don't know who the donors are behind groups like, American Action Network and Citizens United and Americans for Prosperity and some of the other nonprofits that are out there. And they're on both sides. There's a group called Patriot Majority that helped a lot of Democratic candidates that doesn't disclose its donors. But right now, you've got Republicans pretty firmly entrenched against the idea of making this transparent, even though the Supreme Court said that that's what you have to do to make sure that there's not corruption. Because I guarantee you, if somebody was elected with the help of a group like Crossroads GPS, which doesn't disclose its donors, that's one of the Karl Rove-affiliated groups that, spent so much in this election, if those organizations or if those candidates who are helped by those groups, they're going to know who the donors were, and the public is going to have no way to track the what the payback is for that $70 million that Crossroads spent trying to influence elections.
Is the only way to change it though through the Congress, because the courts have already ruled, or is that caveat that they said about transparency allow for some court challenges?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not enough of an expert in the law. I mean, my sense is that Congress has to do something first, that, the Supreme Court really didn't specify anything. But, I'm not sure who you could – I mean, I guess you could sue the FEC, for not forcing them to disclose their donors. But I think the FEC would argue that, well, this is tax law and we have no jurisdiction over it. It's the IRS that has to change it. And I think the last thing in the world the IRS wants to do is to get in the middle of a political dispute between Republicans and Democrats.
All right, sir. I appreciate you bringing us up to date on all that money.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Bill Allison is editorial director of the Sunlight Foundation. They work on transparency of money in politics, earmarks, campaign finance disclosure, and much more. You can find them at sunlightfoundation.com. We put a link at our website, KUOW.org.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the latest research on preventing pneumonia with vaccines. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from the Arbor Group at UBS Financial Services, a wealth management team specializing in sustainable and responsible investing, investments provided for select families and institutions locally and internationally. More information available by searching the Arbor Group at UBS.
Every time my dad has bad news, he takes us out for ice cream. It's kind of his MO. Don't ever go to the Cold Stone Creamery with my dad. Just don't do it.
Join us for this story and more next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Sunday at noon on 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:20. I'm Andy Hurst. We have 45 degrees and partly sunny skies in Seattle. We're expecting partly sunny skies all day today, the high reaching 48. It's going to be cloudy tonight and cold, the low in the mid-30s. Clear and cold tomorrow, the high in the mid-40s.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Pneumonia, still the leading killer of children under age 5 around the world. What's it going to take to turn that around? Next Monday, November 12th, is World Pneumonia Day. Dr. Oren Levine is an expert on vaccines with a focus on pneumonia and meningitis. He's also the new director of vaccine delivery for the Gates Foundation. Dr. Levine, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
I was looking at a children's coloring book that you had tweeted about. And what is that coloring book teaching children and parents around the world?
The coloring book is a creative idea designed to try and make information about the importance of pneumonia, teaching people to recognize the signs and symptoms, and importantly, the steps they can take to protect themselves against pneumonia. And by doing it as a coloring book, we make it much more accessible to children themselves.
Can children prevent getting pneumonia by these steps?
Sure. I think one of the most important interventions that we have for preventing pneumonia is basic hand washing. And that's something that we teach our children all the time. And so it's one of the things that the coloring book does is explains to them the kinds of things that even they can do. And in this case, my third grader, Jessie, actually did something about pneumonia herself by taking that coloring book into school and sharing it with other kids.
So what is pneumonia?
Pneumonia is, as a disease, it's an infection of the lungs. Basically, when germs infect the lungs, they create inflammation, which makes fluid collect in the lungs. And that makes it really hard for kids or adults, but in this case, kids, to get oxygen through breathing. Obviously, oxygen is really important for life. And so when people get pneumonia and it goes untreated and it gets really serious, it can lead to death.
And it's a leading killer around the world. Why is it such a killer around the world?
Yeah, I think most people are surprised when they find this out, that the statistic that pneumonia kills more children than any other illness is really one of the things that people are least aware of. And it's a big global health problem, but it's also solvable. We have really great vaccines that can protect against the most important causes of pneumonia. We know that things like hand washing, breastfeeding, good nutrition, and if you do end up getting sick, the application of simple antibiotics can eliminate most, if not all, of the pneumonia deaths around the world. So it's really an important, urgent problem, but one that's eminently solvable.
It is interesting, Dr. Levine, that breastfeeding up to the age of 2, I think you said, I can't remember, or was it 6 months, that was a strong prevention. Why is that?
Well, breastfeeding is really one of the most important interventions for child health. It not only helps protect against pneumonia, it also helps reduce the risk of other serious diseases like diarrhea. And it typically does that because in the breast milk that gets passed from the mother to the baby, there are protective antibodies and other great nutritional advantages to breastfeeding that then confers that protection or strength onto her baby.
You know, you wrote a an essay in Huffington Post on the five myths about pneumonia that are debunked. And one of the ones you talk about is that pneumonia, this is the myth, pneumonia doesn't affect healthy people. How is it that healthy people can be affected by pneumonia?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, I moved here from the Washington, D.C. area, and I wrote that when Washington Redskins quarterback Rex Grossman was hospitalized from pneumonia. And I thought, this is such a great example. Here's a professional athlete who's been laid down and kept out of the lineup from pneumonia. It's a great example of how if these infections have an opportunity to reach a person with even a strong constitution, if you will, or great athletic ability, they can make those people sick and really either put them in the hospital or sometimes even take their life. And so it's really a problem that everybody needs to be aware of.
Why is smoke so bad? And why is it such an indicator of people who might be susceptible to pneumonia?
Yeah, so it's sort of one of the really more obvious and common sense aspects of pneumonia, that people who live in environments where they're exposed to a lot of smoke, and for people who've been overseas or may have visited some of the rural communities that are typical in parts of South America, Africa, or Asia, will know that in many of their households and living environments, they depend upon charcoal or wood, and they burn them in very basic stoves in order to provide cooking, heat, and the other needs, even light for their household environments. That creates a lot of smoke that irritates the lungs, and that irritation creates a susceptibility and an opportunity for germs to create pneumonia. So reducing smoke through things like improved cook stoves, this is one of Secretary Clinton's leading initiatives, those are the kinds of interventions that we can take to help also reduce the risk of pneumonia through improving people's environments.
Dr. Oren Levine is the new director of vaccine delivery for the Gates Foundation. He's been working on these issues for a number of years with different institutions. He's also speaking Monday night at the University of Washington campus on World Pneumonia Day. Now, you wrote about Malawi and how Malawi, this was a year ago, said that Malawi on World Pneumonia Day became the 16th of the world's poorest countries to introduce the same kinds of advanced pneumococcal vaccines we have in the U.S. And that number is expected to grow to 58 by 2015, representing a huge step forward in the global fight against child mortality. What are the vaccines that can help prevent pneumonia? And then I'm going to ask you about costs and delivery, but what are those vaccines and what do they do?
Great, Steve. This is one of my favorite subjects because as the director for vaccine delivery at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, this is really what we're all about, trying to get these kinds of life-saving vaccines to the children who need them the most. In the case of Malawi, it's a great example of the work that the foundation, together with an international alliance called the Gavi Alliance, and the countries themselves have done in the last decade. Quite simply, what we have done is really turned around the way that we launch these life-saving new products. Historically, the children who got access to life-saving vaccines like the Hib and the pneumococcal pneumonia vaccines were, frankly, the kids who needed it the least, but who lived in countries that could most readily afford it. That's backwards. What we need to do is get the vaccine to the children who need it the most first, even if they live in countries that can't afford it. And that's what we've done with the pneumococcal vaccine now. Essentially, we launched the most complex, most innovative vaccine ever created, the 10 and 13 valent pneumococcal conjugate vaccines, almost simultaneously in the richest and poorest countries of the world. So we were using pneumococcal vaccines in places like Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and Malawi. At the same time, we were using it in places like Seattle, St. Louis, and New York. And that acceleration of the uptake of pneumococcal vaccines, for example, over historical precedents, we project is going to save literally millions of children's lives.
What's it like in terms of, well, how does it work? How does that vaccine work? What's it doing inside the body?
So the way that we make these HIB and pneumococcal conjugate vaccines, these vaccines that protect against the two most important causes of bacterial pneumonia, the really killer pneumonia in developing countries, the way we do it is we take the sugar capsule that surrounds the bacteria and makes it hard for the immune system to attack it. We shave that off of the bacteria. We link it up to a simple vaccine that we've used for years, like a diphtheria or a tetanus vaccine, and then we put it into the vaccine and give it to the children. That then stimulates a protective immune response. It makes the children's immune system recognize those bacteria when they encounter them and clear them. And we've successfully done that for 10 to 13 of the most important strains of bacterial pneumonia now, and that's just making a huge impact on children's lives around the world.
You've been working on vaccines for how many years?
I've been working on trying to advance access for life-saving pneumonia vaccines since the mid-90s, and that's really what brought me here to Seattle and to the Gates Foundation is terrific opportunity as the director of vaccine delivery here to advance that agenda.
Has the science of vaccines changed substantially in those years, or is it all about getting access at this point?
Well, it's both have changed, really. We're in many ways able to do advanced science to harness kind of the advances in science for improved life-saving technologies faster against a broader array of different infections that harm people than ever before. And also importantly, we've come to realize that as hard as it is to do the discovery and all of the steps in the scientific process to make a life-saving vaccines, we need to apply the same kind of creativity, ingenuity, and doggedness to making sure that those vaccines, after they're discovered and developed, reach everybody who needs them.
Dr. Oren Levine is the former executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at Johns Hopkins University. He's now the new director of vaccine delivery for the Gates Foundation. So just a few questions about that. First of all, the problem that is faced in poorer countries is that the systems are broken for getting those vaccines out to people. I mean, physically broken, roads are tough, the trained personnel are not always available. You have to move numbers of people around countries in order to get them to the rural villages. What are you able to harness? What do you think you're harnessing to get those people to the people that need to get the vaccines?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that we face an enormous number of challenges in vaccine delivery around the world. Imagine that we're trying to develop systems that need to reach people in remote Mongolia in the cold in winter and in urban India in the middle of summer. What I think is really exciting about vaccine delivery is that while there are a lot of challenges and a big need for improving our routine immunization systems, those systems that are the very basis for primary health care, that we actually have a lot of success to build on. So, some of the listeners in the Washington area may be surprised to know that in some places like Nicaragua and Rwanda, they probably have immunization coverage rates as high or higher than we have in some parts of the state of Washington or the U.S. itself.
Why is that?
Well, it's just about having really well-organized systems. And in a lot of those places, they've invested in that and they've made that happen. In the United States, we have a very strong immunization system, but we do have some pockets of lower immunization coverage. And so one of the things that makes vaccine delivery in the international space exciting is knowing that while there are challenges in a lot of places that we need to overcome, there's a lot of really great success stories for us to build from as well.
You know, I know that the Gates Foundation is one of those places where they like deliverables. What's your goal for the next for your tenure here?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because we do have some ambitious goals, and I think that's one of the really exciting and defining features of the foundation, where we're committed to the idea that every life has equal value. We've been traditionally focused on helping to accelerate the access to the new life-saving vaccines, the kind of vaccines like the pneumonia vaccines I talked about the rotavirus diarrhea vaccine or meningitis vaccines for Africa. But I think one of the really big differences moving forward is we are focused on strengthening routine immunization systems. And we're going to do that. And we aim, as a consequence of doing that, to reach up to 9 million more children by 2015 as a consequence. We're also going to link that with our efforts to free the world of polio. One of the great things about polio eradication and the polio eradication effort is it really rests on reaching those last mile populations, those children that live in the most difficult to reach areas. And we can really build off of that to strengthen routine immunization and overall health care for those populations.
So is the idea being that if you're getting a pneumonia vaccine, and you can double up and get the polio at the same time? You just economies of scale sort of thing?
That's part of it. Part of it is taking the huge teams and all the learnings that we've gotten out of how do we reach people with polio vaccines and applying it to the pneumonia vaccine. And on the routine immunization front, we're going to build up routine immunization systems so that they regularly deliver life-saving vaccines to children in that first year of life. But while we're doing that, we're going to talk to them about breastfeeding, and we're going to strengthen their nutrition, and we're going to deliver things like bed nets that prevent them from malaria and vitamin A that helps their immune system. So routine immunization and that focus is really going to build systems that support a broad range of life-saving interventions.
So finally, Dr. Levine, you know, we were talking about developing worlds, developing countries. We have a pretty strong influenza vaccination effort that goes on here in the U.S. and here in Washington State. Who should get vaccinated for pneumonia?
So I'm glad you brought that up because I do think it's really important when we celebrate World Pneumonia Day that people realize this is not a problem of just people in impoverished communities around the world in faraway places. It's a problem back here. And everybody of all ages is potentially at risk. So influenza vaccines are recommended for nearly everybody in the United States, and they are really important for helping to prevent the risk of pneumonia. Oftentimes in this country, bacterial pneumonias follow an influenza episode. So when you get that pneumonia vaccine, you are helping to prevent pneumonias as well. There's also vaccines.
When you get the influenza vaccine, you're helping prevent pneumonia as well.
Yeah, well said. Thanks. Sorry, I mixed up my influenza and pneumonia there. Get the influenza vaccine. It'll help protect you against pneumonia. And importantly, for seniors ages 55 and older, there's a pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine that they should also get that will take away the consequences of one of the really important causes of bacterial pneumonia.
All right, sir. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Oren Levine is the new director of vaccine delivery for the Gates Foundation. Monday, he's speaking at University of Washington campus on November 12th. To talk about pneumonia. It is World Pneumonia Day on November 12th. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:39. I'm Andy Hurst. Charles Sabin was a war correspondent for NBC for 25 years. He covered conflicts all over the world, including Bosnia, Baghdad, and the Rwanda genocide. But 4 years ago, his focus completely changed after he took a genetic test. He'll tell a story to KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Western Washington University MBA program, offering flexibility while pursuing an MBA with full-time, evening, and weekend options. Information sessions in November in Bellingham, Everett, and Seattle. More at cbe.wwu.edu/mba.
Traveling really light can be the most fun of all.
We didn't shower for weeks. We camped on golf courses, the tops of mountains.
Dan Austin recalls the cross-country bike trip that changed his life. And Ference Mate knows it's the simplest things that can give the most pleasure.
One of the proudest things I do, I grow garlic. Nothing is more thrilling than sticking 100 cloves in the ground and seeing every one of them come up.
Follow your bliss on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
And that comes your way Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW World Series, presenting Cedar Lake Contemporary Ballet, performing a program of Seattle premieres by Canadian Crystal Pite and other international choreographers. November 15th through the 17th at Meany Hall. Tickets at uwworldseries.org.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. King County.
This has been an amazingly political last few weeks, and guess what? It's always that way on radio since just about the time it was invented. Katie Sewell's here with another look back for our radio retrospective. The year of radio, you're calling 1924.
That's what certain magazines were calling it. The election of 1924 was the first time the brave new technology of radio was used during the presidential election.
Wow.
But let's step back a little bit, shall we? To February 8th, 1922, because that was the day that President Warren G. Harding had the first radio installed into the White House.
Really?
Yes.
It was a big deal, I bet.
It was a big deal. At the time, radio was the hottest technology, but it was also not incredibly widespread in 1922 because the home consoles were still being developed. So the White House is really on the cutting edge there by putting in their own. But I thought maybe as a diversion before we get into the election, it would be fun to listen back as to why radios were so difficult back in the early 20s. They were not very user-friendly, as you might imagine. They're being developed. They required three different types of batteries at the time.
Really?
A, B, and C batteries, and they had to be changed a lot, like very frequently. And tuning in a radio station wasn't easy either. There was a lot of static.
Hey, come on.
And then the radio waves were oscillating. And then they would also have mixed in squeals and peaks within the content.
Can't you see? He's the Red Cross.
Addressing can...
That reminds me of how I used to think of ham radios sounding.
Yeah, and if you think that's bad, let me point out that those recordings were actually made years after this point because we didn't have the recordings and it had been worse than that. So fidgeting with the dial was so ongoing if you had a radio. And if you didn't set it properly, you would not only be bothering yourself, you would be broadcasting those squeals over to your neighbor's set.
Your neighbor's set would pick up all the your off tune?
Yes.
Wow.
So... and then, of course, when we think of radio, we think of it having one tuning knob to tune in the content.
Stepping up the big... That's it, isn't
it? Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, that sounds right. But a single knob wasn't actually offered to the public until the late 1920s. In 1923, when people started actually having radios in their homes, the most popular radio models had narrowed that down into three different tuning knobs.
So they're using three knobs to tune in the frequency.
Yep.
Hence all
the
batteries.
Which explains why they didn't change the channel a lot, too. Once you had something, you had it. You know, leave it be.
It didn't click into place either, right? Because you really had to tune it.
So let's jump back to Warren G. Harding, though. He's the first to install the radio, and he did make occasional radio speeches. One of the most famous ones was when he was trying out a new high-powered RCA transmitter in 1921, and they think that was heard on every continent. So
really,
that's a big deal.
So that's why radio is so impressive to people, how you could broadcast your voice around the world.
Yeah, so new. But it was President Calvin Coolidge who was the first presidential candidate to successfully use radio to actually help him win re-election. Vice President Calvin Coolidge had assumed the presidency after Warren G. Harding had died very suddenly. In fact, he was so sudden he was in mid-conversation with his wife while he died. When he died, he was currently on a cross-country speaking tour when he passed away. And so by the time we get to 1924, Coolidge was up for re-election against Democratic candidate John W. Davis and the progressive candidate Robert Lafayette.
Robert Lafayette. Lafayette's the man. Wisconsin. He was the progressive of the time.
Didn't get much of the vote, but he was out there. Up to this point, politics had dabbled a little bit with radio, but many of the politicians that we're seeing at that time still think it's novelty, like that there's nothing good about it. A great example I found was in 1923, a microphone was put in front of the former Secretary of State, and he was noted saying, "Take that away. I can talk to a Democrat, but I can't speak into a dead thing."
Really nice. He's right.
But as we come into the election of 1924, political candidates are starting to think about radio as being part of their campaigns. In fact, so many of them went off about how they were going to use radio this year that political committees were formed to try to manage their airtime requests.
Really? Yeah. So it was the, wow, look at Twitter and its effect on campaigns.
We need to get involved with this radio. New Republic magazine at the time speculated that the election would be fought over the airwaves, and The Nation was the magazine that declared that 1924 would be looked back at as the radio year of the election. Incidentally, they also wrote in that same article that they thought that the radio fad would be over by 1928. So, like, this was the only chance that radio was going to be used in the election. So they did broadcast quite a bit on the radio in 1924. The Republican and the Democratic conventions were carried on several radio stations. The speeches by all the candidates and their vice presidential nominees were played. But it was the final speech given by Calvin Coolidge on the night before the election that made history. On that night, 26 different stations coast to coast carried the speech. And that was a lot at the time. That was unprecedented. And it was estimated that the audience listening was the largest in history to ever listen to one man at that point.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Of course, I don't have a recording of that speech because technology being what it was in 1924, they didn't have any recordings.
Or they didn't think about it, right? They didn't see it as something for posterity.
Yeah. So, but I wanted to give you an idea of how he would have sounded. So here is President Coolidge speaking on film from the White House in 1924. I should also note that he was also the first president to ever be filmed with sound, which is kind of an interesting side note. And here's an excerpt of that film.
The expenses of the government reach everybody. Taxes take from everyone a part of his earnings and force everyone to work for a certain part of his time for the government. When we come to realize that the yearly expenses of the governments of this country, the stupendous sum of about $7,500,000,000, is needed by the national government. Such a sum is difficult to comprehend. It represents all the pay of 5 million wage earners receiving $5 a day, working 300 days in the year. If the government should add $100 million of expense, it would represent 4 days more work of these wage earners. These are some of the reasons why I want to cut down public expense. I want the people of America to be able to work less for the government and more for themselves.
Well, was that just last week? Was that Mitt Romney?
Yeah, I know. We still hear those same arguments.
That was Calvin Coolidge.
That's Calvin Coolidge, 1924, from the White House. He's making a little bit of a partisan argument there. On the speech he gave the night before the election, he was just encouraging people to vote.
Oh, is that right?
And he ended it in a very warm way that really endeared people to him. He said, "To my father who's listening in my old home in Vermont, and to my many other invisible audience, I say goodnight." And people thought that was really nice. Next day, Coolidge wins by a landslide.
All because of radio.
Not so much, actually. The night after the election closed, almost every station in the country for the first time was broadcasting some kind of election returns. It's estimated that 20 million people tuned in to listen. And many of the stations were broadcasting the returns until 1 in the morning. This had never happened before. KDKA in Pittsburgh stayed on the latest. They kept doing it until 4 a.m.
I would have liked to have heard those early pundits filling time in between election returns. They weren't getting the kind of results at the snappy pace that we get them now. And even so, people have to wait.
Yep, have to wait, 4 a.m. Well, let's look at the takeaways of how the 1924 election actually brings us to today. It did have a great significance on how radio developed and also the kind of politicians that we have. Because, the election wasn't close. Coolidge was going to win anyway. People were very happy with him. So it wasn't radio that tipped it. But radio was credited with letting people focus on the election more for the first time, like making it a cultural focus of what's going on.
Across the country.
Across the country. So takeaways, though, that it did affect radio. So before 1924, AT&T thought that it was impossible to connect stations from coast to coast. And remember, we had just heard that they hooked up 26 different stations across the country. So by the end of the election cycle, they'd been doing this. It was no longer a mystery. They knew that they could do it, and we see them building from there.
Oh, so the development of networks.
Exactly. The election also gave developers of new technology a reason to work faster. So people who were coming up with new radio technology wanted to get it done by the time the election.
Are you telling me that government encouraged job creation?
Yeah.
You radical.
Not even that. The money paid by the different parties to the radio stations kept radio stations alive and actually helped them to grow. Democrats spent $40,000. The Republicans spent $50,000, which isn't much by these standards of today, but it was a windfall at the time for the radio stations. And broadcasting also changed how our political candidates are. In this election, they went from doubting that radio had any validity whatsoever and who's going to hear my messages to knowing that it worked. And then they also had to change their tone. They had to become warmer. And so a lot of politicians in the day were like these fire and brimstone speakers.
Well, so what's an example? Franklin Roosevelt?
Franklin Roosevelt is a fine example of not yelling at the audience anymore, but talking to them comfortably and making it sound like he's in your living room.
That's what he was doing. That's mm-hmm. how he was working at it. All right, so this is what you have, a little bit of his fireside chat.
Yeah, from 1933. It's an example of how he's not yelling anymore. He's chatting.
After all, there is an element in the readjustment of our financial system more important than currency, more important than gold, and that is the confidence of the people themselves. Confidence and courage are the essentials of success in carrying out our plan. You people must have faith. You must not be stampeded by rumors or guesses. Let us unite in banishing fear. We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system, and it is up to you to support and make it work. It is your problem, my friend, your problem no less than it is mine. Together, we cannot fail.
So candidates today no longer talk to us like we're just showing up at their speeches. They have to talk to us where we actually are, in our homes. And that started in 1925.
Sitting in 24. Our kitchens. All right. Thanks, Katie.
You're welcome.
Now, after this long day, and let's face it, long week, you need a good lunch suggestion, which is what Sarah Dickerman brings us. She writes about food and the business of food and the eating of food and the bookings of food at sarahdickerman.com. She also writes for Slate and the New York Times. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
Where shall I go to, help soothe the franticness and the happiness or sadness of this week?
Well, I think that it's always good to return to an old reliable. Sometimes we get so interested in what the newest thing is that we forget about the old places that really deliver pleasure. And one of those, especially for lunch and brunch, is Cafe Campagna in the market.
Now, Cafe Campagna, boy, you're right. I love that place. I've only been there a few times. That's a great place.
Yeah, it's super yummy. I always like to sit at bars, but I find their bar particularly nice. The servers always know what they're doing, and they know about their wines. There's always an interesting French country wine to discover there, so I recommend a glass of wine with lunch in this case.
What do you like to have there?
Well, one thing that is so good at this time of year is their duck salad.
The duck confit salad?
The duck confit salad, yes.
Confit.
And that is, it's a bit of a stretch to call it a salad. It's sort of like a warm slaw of cabbage with duck mixed into it, and they serve it with these croutons with duck liver pâté on top, and it's a very hearty lunch, and it's delicious.
Yeah, well, that's a stretch to call it a salad, I guess, but I mean, it is salad-y, right?
It is salad-y. It's warm, though, versus, it's more like, the classic bistro salad that you might also, I think they also do sometimes, which is, just that warm, the idea of the warm juxtaposing with the vegetable, and it's really yummy. And then, they do the sort of melty cheese, delicious Coque Monsieur, and, which is like a French take on the grilled cheese sandwich, and they do wonderful open-faced sandwiches called tartines with, various, either their gravlax or like pork rillettes spread on an open-faced sandwich. And it's just a nice, congenial place. It's right near the market if you're visiting the market with out-of-town travelers or you want to have a business lunch somewhere near there.
Pork rillettes sounds good.
Yeah.
Now you're just making me hungry. I know it must be. Must be getting on to time to eat. I'm getting hungry. Just you saying the words, and I start to salivate. Okay. Cafe Campagna in the market. It sounds like a fine lunch place to soothe or celebrate after this week. All right. What about what should we be cooking? What book should we be looking at?
Well, I chose because this is a Cafe Campagna, is a great West Coast French inspired restaurant. I thought, well, one of the classic authors that really guided Alice Waters and other American chefs charmed by country French food is Richard Olney, who was a painter and wrote this wonderful book called Simple French Food, and he's just a really lively writer. He's a little bit imperious, which though I don't always like in person, I actually kind of like in a cookbook.
You do? Why? Why do you like that in a cookbook?
I think it suggests that someone really has observed the ways to do things and has developed an opinion. And I think that's a good thing in this case. He has opinions on what kind of vegetables to choose, what kind of cheeses to use for a particular dish, how vigorously to stir something. And all that, I think, gives guidance to a cook trying to explore new dishes.
Because you can either agree with him and go along with him, or you can also sort of like have an opinion, therefore bounce off his opinion to get your own.
Yeah, and I think a lively writer is a lively writer, no matter what form you're reading.
And he did the artwork?
He did the artwork, and there are these lovely, there's not a ton of illustrations, but there's some very lovely evocative pen and ink drawings that that make it extra charming. It was written in 1974, and then, at a time when, French cooking was very much a more formal kind of cooking in the American imagination. And so he really loosened things up, I think, for Americans and allowed for that kind of West Coast vision of French cuisine to develop.
Which is an example of which is Café Campagne, open-faced sandwiches with the tartines and the roulette.
Hearty soups and hearty salads and things that aren't necessarily, carefully presented with, a little carrot flour, carrot carvings, on top of it. It's a much looser, more informal style of eating that I think fits our contemporary lifestyle well.
Yeah, West Coast especially. Country-style French cooking, simple French food, Richard Olney's cookbook, and Cafe Campagna in the market. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Dickerman writes at sarahdickerman.com. You can also find her work at Slate, New York Times, other publications. We'll talk to you again next week.
See you then.
Tomorrow we'll look back on this political week. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst, our engineer. We get help from Alexandra Garrettin, Danielle Anthony Goodwin. Have a good day.
Stick around for NPR News coming up next. Good morning. It's 10:59. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to more than 120 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, China's Communist Party chooses its new leaders as reporters struggle to report on a process shrouded in mystery.
Last night, there was a notice posted on the 18th Party Congress Press Center website saying, "Hey guys, we can now tell you that this event will take a week to wrap up."
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 6 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.